I also had a very bad, well, race-related incident in the workplace that got me to a point where I was depressed.
Oh my.
I was on antidepressants and I couldn't do anything, let alone care for my son, who was just 2 or 3 years then.
Mm-hmm. So would you be okay sharing what happened?
Unfortunately, I'm bound by a legal document, so I can't speak about it. But that's the thing, that's another thing. You know, I was in such a bad place and I didn't know about the HR laws.
Yeah.
You know, didn't know my rights. And I basically just signed off my rights to talk about this ever again without getting paid a penny for it. Am I smarter as a result of that? Yeah, but what that taught me was to, you know, one was learn everything I could.
Yeah, yeah.
And second, I would never want somebody to be in the same position that I was.
Welcome to your favorite voice of business psychology, the Psych and Success Podcast. I am your host, Kritika Kashyap. Guys, this is only part one of the eye-opening conversation with Lizelle, the global training manager at Financial Times, and a fierce yet warm advocate for change, who challenges the status quo of inclusive leadership. With over 18 years of experience in training and development, Lizelle dives into the workplace dynamics and, with her personal stories, shedding light on the issues of colorism, racial discrimination, and fostering psychological safety. Get ready for a candid conversation that explores the nuances of creating an inclusive and equitable corporate culture, one where every voice matters.
Hi, Lizelle. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Psych and Success.
Thank you for having me, Kritika. I'm really pleased to be here.
I had connected to you over LinkedIn, and that is how we met. And now we are, I love it that you are on my podcast. And you know what? So one thing that I would like to share with you before we start the podcast is one thing that I greatly learned from you was to just help people regardless of anything, to just go above and beyond and help people. And from you, because you have helped me so much through my career and my not so good times, that I then started helping out people out of my, going out of my way. I mean, I knew that I have to help and I used to, but now I consciously do that. So that was a great, great, you know, add-on that you have done in my life. I'm so, so grateful for that.
Oh, thank you, Kritika. That is, it's very humbling to know that. And I'm not really good at taking compliments.
I can see that.
But I'm pleased that that's something you took from our conversations and our many, many long conversations. And, you know, I think that's all we can do for each other is help people. And I was watching this Netflix series on, it was about, I think it was The Search for Joy.
Okay.
I think that's what it's called, but I could be wrong. And it's, it has the Dalai Lama and his friend, who is this amazing African preacher who, you know, took South Africa through some very difficult and dark periods. And one of the things that they both constantly talk about in their conversations with each other is about how life is about helping one another. And, you know, apparently there was a study done, kindness study.
Okay.
Where it showed in that study that people who did kind deeds were more likely to be healthier. So kindness pays.
Okay.
Yeah. Just happy about the fact that, you know, whatever happens, that never stops.
Yeah, that is so true. And because I'm a huge believer of karma as well.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that was what I wanted to share with you, which I've never shared really. And I already know quite a bit about you. So why don't you share or introduce yourself to the listeners?
Okay. So I'm Lizelle Nathaniel, and I have been in learning and development all my professional life. Well, most of my professional life. It's about 20 years now in training and development, learning and development. But apart from that, I'm also quite passionate about diversity and inclusion. And that's mainly about my professional sort of side of me.
Hmm.
Other than that, personally, I have an 8-year-old cheeky little boy.
So cute. I just had him. He is the cutest.
Thank you. You know, I love listening to music.
Okay.
I love cooking. I find it therapeutic. Not quite sure whether my dishes are tasty, but I like cooking it. I like how they taste. So,
just for the listeners, just the meat-based cooking that you are into.
Correct. Of course, you know that firsthand. But it is on my list to learn how to cook good vegetarian food as well. I love reading.
Is there any particular thing that you're reading or that you loved that you just suggest to everybody to, everybody should read?
Well, I think, you know, I think there are a couple of books that have changed my life in certain ways. But it's not one particular book.
Mm.
I, at the minute, am reading a book on the caste system of America.
Oh.
And there is no caste system in America, but if you look at the hierarchy of race,
mm-hmm.
it pretty much mirrors the caste system in India.
Is it?
Where,
interesting.
Yes. So where black people are almost like the untouchables, mm-hmm. or they used to be, you know, not anymore. It's changing. It has changed.
Mm.
But that's not enough, is it?
Yeah.
So it just basically talks about, you know, Martin Luther King, and obviously about how when he came to India and he saw the caste system.
Right.
And, you know, and he realized as well how, like, you know, the racial structure was like the caste system. Of course, they say in India, as you know, that the caste system has been abolished, but it still exists.
Because getting into the intricacies and learning and understanding how the society has been built, because now we live in a multicultural, multi-ethnicity society in general, that it also reflects, although it's not called casteism, but it still reflects even in the corporate world. Would you want to continue with the personal Lizelle, or should I move to the next question?
Next question.
Okay. All right. So I would want to know that what got you so interested into, because you said you are an advocate of diversity and inclusion. What got you so interested in it?
Well, I suppose growing up in India, in Mumbai, colorism was always there.
Yeah.
Right? Unless you were fair or wheatish, you know, that impacted you in family, in school, who would be picked to be on stage, who was thought to be clever, who was thought to be affluent, you know, in college and university that followed. So everywhere this being sort of dark skinned has affected me, that even now when I go back to India, I get anxiety.
Really?
Because what if somebody calls me a slur?
Oh God.
How will I react? So when I came to the UK, I think I came with like rose-colored lenses. You know, I married an English person, a man. I was 4 months pregnant when I moved here. We had to move here because of a personal circumstance. And to be honest, I had a couple of, well, racial insults thrown my way once or twice.
Okay.
In about 2 years that I lived, in Newark in Nottinghamshire.
Hmm.
But it's only when I started to go to work did I, in the workplace, in my first job, that I realized that there is this untold, unspoken about, covert racial structure. Because you look around in most workplaces, I say most workplaces because, that's what the studies, most studies show, is that, depending on where you work, obviously, you won't see many people like you in places of power, in places of authority, at senior leadership levels.
Right.
It gets paler and paler.
Yeah.
And whiter and whiter as you climb. And that is, whether you like it or not, that is the hard truth. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, I also had a very bad, race-related incident in the workplace that, really got me to a point where I was depressed.
Oh my.
I was on antidepressants and I couldn't do anything, let alone care for my son, who was just about two or three years then.
Mm-hmm. So would you be okay sharing what happened, what racial situation happened with you?
Unfortunately, I'm bound by a legal document, so I can't speak about it. But that's the thing, that's another thing. I was in such a bad place and I didn't know anything about the country.
Right.
Didn't know about the HR laws.
Yeah.
Didn't know my rights. And I basically just signed off my rights to talk about this ever again without getting paid a penny for it.
Oh my God.
So am I smarter as a result of that? Yeah. But what that taught me was to, one was learn everything I could.
Yeah.
And second, I would never want somebody to be in the same position that I was.
Of course.
And so, touch wood, thankfully, I haven't been back in that place. I've worked in two places since and, they've both been really, really good places to work at. There's that covert sort of racial structure everywhere and the hierarchy everywhere.
Yeah.
You can't escape it. And most organizations are doing the best that they can, including the one that I work in right now, the Financial Times. Given the brand image that the Financial Times does have, I know for a fact that it is working very, very hard to do its best.
Yeah.
And make that change that people want to see.
Mm. So, because I have seen a lot of big companies, MNCs, they promote about they being diverse and very inclusive. And as you had mentioned that as we climb up the ladder, we see mostly white and not just white, but white men. So if companies are promoting so much of diversity and inclusiveness, how do you think that it is still on the leadership position, on the change making position, it is still the same? The inclusivity is not really seen. It's mostly the lower level employees that we see the inclusivity that is happening.
So I think there are a couple of things about this. It depends on what an organization will commit to. I think if you force change in a very short amount of time, it might have ripple effects.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think most organizations that we work for, multinational companies, Fortune 500 companies, large organizations, they're not charities.
Of course.
They run on profits, right?
Yeah.
And the one thing that they can't afford for is for people to leave. So change has to be, it has to be there.
Hmm.
You have to be talking about it. You can't be afraid to use the word race.
Hmm.
But diversity and inclusion is just not about race. It's about the LGBTQ community as well. It's about people with accessibility needs.
True. It's also about like different perspectives and ideas. People.
Correct. So, you know, at the end of the day, which of the three do we see statistically be most impacted at race? And as Asians, we have it better than our Black counterparts.
Okay.
We have it better. We're called the model minority. It's not for nothing. Because we're taught from a very early age, put your head down and just get on with it. Don't ask any questions. Get on with it. And that attitude of ours means we don't question anything.
Yeah.
We're happy being in somebody else's shadow. And I think, so there are different kinds of racial structures in organizations. And I think it will take time.
Right.
It will take time to break through those barriers for people to think, oh, you know what? This is the UK. Traditionally, this is a white country, according to them.
Yeah.
So why should we want anybody else up there? And I think that mindset is so deep within them. It's going to take some time to get used and grapple with the facts that we will see people of very diverse senior leadership, sort of diversity in senior leadership at, you know, board level, especially.
Right.
But it's the fact of the matter is that who are the people that don't have the best education? Where is there the most crime? Where is there the most drugs? Right? Who's doing anything to empower people to get out of those situations? If that's all you know,
yeah,
and people are not doing anything to improvise those areas,
right?
You know, then those children don't have the opportunities. Right? They don't have the opportunities because that's their life. And that's what they think, that's all they think their world is. What is the government doing about that?
It's just like a loop that, you know, the kids, they're growing up. Of course, no kid would ever grow up thinking, oh, I would, you know, do this crime or be this petty. They would be ambitious. They would be full of that, you know, I want to be this. I want to make this money. I want to be like in a good position and everything. But it's just the circumstances, the lack of education, the lack of resources that put them into the situation. And because of the situation, they have to do petty things. And because of that, again, people other than them, the different ethnicity, feel like, oh, these people are mostly into, they're bad people. They're not as good as us. And they do not get good position. They, again, do not get good resources. And the loop continues.
Correct. So I'm not saying everybody living in areas, certain areas are, you know, criminals or, you know, but they don't have, there's a lack of opportunities. Nobody cares about a certain type of society because it's in everybody's best interest to have them where they're at.
Yeah.
But I think there are organizations that are doing something about it. There are organizations that are, you know, have help people, children or bright students from, or even just students, you know, give them opportunities to come out of there. And I think that's what's important is that as much as you're a profit-making company, that you're going back and you're giving back. You know, you're improving communities. You're changing communities. And I think that's important. You're not doing it because you want the
fame.
You want the, you know, yeah, fame. You want that bit of it.
Yeah.
So like, for example, you know, the Financial Times, you know, they have a lot of initiatives.
Okay.
Early careers initiatives. And, you know, very few people outside the FT actually know about it.
Oh, okay. So is there a reason why?
I mean, because it's nobody's doing it for fame. Nobody's doing it because they want to increase their profits and show Oh, we're just a very, you know, we do this and we do that.
So, okay, good.
There's always initiatives. And if you come up with an idea and they think that, if leadership think that it's a good idea, then, you know, nobody stops you from doing it. They'll encourage you.
That's amazing.
They'll ask questions, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think in some ways, a lot of people have this image, you know, this idea about the Financial Times and the brand image. Yes, do we have diversity at board level? No. Do we have diversity from a race perspective at senior leadership level? No.
Okay.
But I believe that there are steps being taken to change that now. Mm-hmm. They're open to things. You know, we just got a new head of diversity and inclusion. It feels like by hiring somebody like that, and you know, the experience that she comes from and her values, I think we are getting on that track. It will be slow, you know, because immediately if you try to change things,
that cannot happen.
I mean, yeah.
A behavior change requires continuous hammering or finding or just an environment.
Correct.
That you build upon.
I think slowly we've got to change systems. We've got to change processes. We've got to change mindsets. We've got to change so much. Sometimes that takes years.
And especially when it's large companies, it's multinational companies, because there's so many processes within itself. And there's so many people from all across all walks of life. They come together and working together. So it's very difficult to ingrain that culture within themselves, within the company.
Yeah. But I think as Asians, we're still at very high levels in places, right? Microsoft CEO.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's so many other CEOs you can talk of. That not only CEOs, but, you know, people at very, very high levels. Rishi Sunak, right? We have no problem getting there. But what are we doing to help our Black counterparts? Are we stepping on their backs to get where we want to get? Are we fighting for them? Are we saying, you know, like, treat, like, come on, you know, do something for them as well? And I think that's where the problem is that we Asians, we look down on Black people.
Okay.
I mean, you go to India, even the poorest person will look down on a Black person who's much richer, who will probably be much richer than them, more educated than them. But just by the nature of the color of their skin, they will be looked down on. I mean, what have they done to deserve that?
Yeah, that's I think, just the ugly truth.
It is the ugly truth. And we as Asians need to change that, you know? I mean, the one thing, you know, when I was in my 20s, I happened to fall in love with an American.
It's the first internet dating sort of
thing. Okay. But anyway, we were young and we thought, oh, we're very serious with each other.
Yeah.
Things like that. We're like, oh, we'll get married and whatever. And I remember somebody saying this to one of my uncles. Oh, Lizard's, you know, like, dating an American.
Oh, okay.
And he was like, well, you better not be Black.
Oh my God.
Well, I look Black. You know, my people think I'm Black. I've been called Black, you know, as a slur all my life in India. Black people mistake me for Black. And here he's telling me, I better not be Black. So, you know, and that's my thing. What are we doing to help others? If you have something more than somebody else, why won't you give somebody the hand to lift them up? And that's what's important, is to change our mindsets towards Black people, which means getting people that are not used to Black people, you know, getting them used to it, fighting on their behalf when even they're not there. You know, when I say fighting, I mean, you know, advocating for them.
Yeah, just standing up for them.
Standing up for them. Not being a bystander.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think those are the things that you can do as a human race for one another.
That's very eye-opening when you said, I mean, being of a certain color other than white, even when you have, you come from a privileged background, you have the privilege, it's only when that you are in the position of a non-privileged person, you understand that, you know, this is unfair, that is unfair, and the people who are being unfair. But once you get into the level of privilege, you just shut yourself from seeing those things and just, you know, understanding about your own society and they're doing well and everything, but not really understanding what is happening with the people who are not as privileged as you are. And that is so important to be get out of our own shell and also understand from their perspective, know their stories, and understand where are they coming from and what kind of challenges have they been facing to, as you said, to help them and to uplift everybody together. And that is, I think that is what diversity and inclusivity would mean.
That's what humanity means. You know, you don't have to do big grand gestures.
Mm-hmm.
It's the smallest things help. You know, for example, if you are in a power of any privilege in any, look across in your meeting rooms virtually. Who is that one person that just is not, is there's nobody to talk about the good things that they do? Are you bringing them forward? Are you championing them? You know? And those are a couple of things that I think I mindfully do as a leader. First of all, I have studied extensively about, and I continue to study about race.
Okay.
A book that I read and I have it on my bedstand is about the science of race. How far back this nonsense goes of, you know, it trying to be proved that black people were basically animals, that their intelligence was of animals. And that's how people see black people, right? It's like that myth that was created all those years ago. I'm talking about like hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
Where they were measuring skulls to show that, oh, they've got a larger skull size, so that means they're less intelligent, or they're not intelligent. You know, Asians were known for our intelligence.
Okay.
You know, Indians IT, right?
Yeah.
Asians IT. So you've got all these different things. But, you know, if you're Muslim, that's a different thing. There's a different stigma that comes to it.
Right.
Right? If you are Muslim and you're black, that's even worse for you.
True.
Right?
Yeah.
And you've got to look at these things as leaders. It's so deep within certain people to think a certain way.
Hmm.
You know? That as leaders, we don't do enough to champion them. What is equality? We talk about diversity, equality, but actually it's equity, isn't it?
Yeah.
What is equity? What is equity? Equity is basically giving somebody the same opportunities to come to a certain standard where they're starting the race at the same place as you are.
Right. Yep.
But you're so disadvantaged. Some people are so, most, I mean, you know, racially, they're so far behind. And then you're like, yeah, catch up. And as leaders, we have that opportunity. You know, I'm not at a massively high position.
Right.
But I am in a position where, you know, I have a sizable team. And what can I do?
Yeah. So what means when you say that you're a leader? What does leadership mean to you?
Oh, what does leadership mean to me? I think leadership to me, first and foremost, means being compassionate and kind. It's being emotionally intelligent and empathetic. And you're not going to get it right all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But you learn from your mistakes and you make sure you don't make those mistakes again when it comes to people. At the end of the day, everybody's different.
Yeah.
Everybody comes with their own life experience, but never stop caring. That's not to say that you are a yes person.
Okay.
You have to make tough decisions.
True.
You know, there are sometimes you'll have to pull people by, you know, their socks and say, you know, what's going on?
Yeah.
But it's understanding, like, what happened, you know?
It's more about a conversation than being authoritatively asking.
Yes, being directive. Sometimes you have to be in a, like, when there's a crisis.
Yeah.
You have no choice, right? There's very little time. And at that point, you know, even in that point, I'd be like, listen, I'm really sorry. However, here's the situation. So here's why I'm being directive. Because otherwise, I will be like, okay, so tell me what you think.
Yeah.
Tell me what you think. Tell me what you think. And I, and being that sort of collaborative person, I'm sorry, having that collaborative team.
Yeah.
Means everybody's helping each other. As a leader, it's not divide and conquer. It's how do I make my team so unified that they don't need me? I know it's like, why would you do that, right? Right?
Yeah.
But they do need you. They need you for that strategic, you know, everybody needs somebody to look up to, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, organically, somebody will get nominated as a leader and everybody start looking up to them.
Man.
I've gone on, you know, a holiday for 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay.
And my teams function absolutely fine.
So when you say that, I mean, from the look of it, collaborative team and asking everybody, you know, what do you think? Isn't it and companies being very, you know, profit focused and very target oriented? Because these things takes a lot of time. Do you think that this is always the best way to go around when, you know, you're always target-bounded, you're always time-bounded with your projects that you do?
Even if you've got targets, right? Who's achieving those targets? People.
Yeah.
If you don't, as a leader, if you don't take on board what somebody in your team is telling you, you know, just by cracking the whip. Yeah, you crack the whip. And, you know, they'll be like, shit, I need to meet my targets. I need to meet my numbers.
Yeah.
They might do that. But they'll break. They'll go. You lose good people. Right? So instead, you know, you need to develop your people. So, you know, there's a reason you're a leader.
Yeah.
You're not a leader to crack the whip. You're a leader to motivate, encourage. And I think you can achieve that without having to, you know, be like that. For example, you know, like let's say you're in a sales team, right? And you've got high targets to meet.
Yeah.
Right? You can have daily stand-ups. 15 minutes, get the team together.
Yeah.
You know, everybody shares their learnings.
Okay.
And that's it. It's all it takes is 15 minutes. Oh, I did this. But this client, you know, wasn't that receptive.
Yeah.
I think it's because of this. Somebody over there might go to a client and, you know, need that input.
Right.
I was very competitive in sales.
Okay.
Right? You don't want to share your trade secrets because you want to make sure. But at the end of the day, is it about, you know, what is it about? Like, can you help each other to make targets together? Can you learn from each other? So I think collaboration works in so many ways. I mean, nowadays, we, you know, at the touch of a phone button, laptop screen, you know, you can be connected to anybody anywhere.
Nothing
that should stop us from being collaborative. And, well, if you're not making your targets, then what is it? Why?
Okay.
You know, what is the reason? And understanding somebody rather than... And that's the problem, is that we're not emotionally intelligent.
Emotional intelligence, if you talk about, this is training bit. Does that help? And to what extent?
I know I'm in training and learning. But learning is not an event. It's a campaign.
Yeah.
Right? I can go for... an emotional intelligence workshop. Nowadays, there are 3-hour workshops. All you get is a download.
Yeah.
Guidelines.
It's just a theory part
yeah.
that you understand.
But if you don't put something to use, you're never going to learn. Right?
True.
I mean, we live in such a selfish world where everything is me. I think about myself. As leaders, we need to be more emotionally intelligent of other, you know, empathetic, understanding, compassionate, not soft, not
right.
passive, assertive. People are looking at you for leadership.
True.
You should be able to hold your own and lead people through the, you know, through a lot of things.
Yeah.
There are sometimes you need to lead from the front. There are sometimes you need to be right at the back and let somebody else go in the front.
True.
As a leader, you need to know how to do that. But if you don't know your people really well,
yeah,
you don't know what makes them tick. Then you know, as you said, training change? I don't think 3 hours can change anything. It's like driving a car. You know, I can learn to drive a car, but if I never touch that car again, can I take it out on the road? No. Or if I just learn theory, you know, there's a reason you have a practical test too.
Yeah, of course, because you'll have to do it practically.
Correct. Or you'll kill people, right?
Yeah.
Or you'll get killed yourself.
True.
You just can't learn it through a book. And that's the same thing. You know, you can't just learn something and not practice it. So we can send people on emotional intelligence trainings as much as we want. But if nobody's coaching those leaders to hold a mirror to themselves and, hey, you know, are you doing that? Because traditionally, fear and respect are so convoluted and so mixed.
Yeah.
Right? If I fear somebody, means I respect them. No. You know, I don't want my team to fear me.
Because if they fear you, they are not going to tell you the truth. You would never really understand about
it. Correct. And that is why so many companies have reached the zenith. They've reached the pinnacle. And they've come crashing down.
Oh.
Because they have had no psychological safety to tell the truth. Or when they've told the truth, they themselves have become a target. And you can read, you know, Amy Edmondson's book, the book that you wrote on psychological safety. Okay. And see how many examples of companies that you have who have lost millions, if not billions. You know, planes have crashed.
Okay.
Just because people are fearful of authority.
Yeah.
So, you know, and can a 3-hour workshop change that? Can a 2-day workshop change that? I don't think so.
Absolutely not.
So, as a learning and development person, there has to be regular interventions. After that, after that emotional, intelligence, empathy, training, what other interventions follow? Who is there to see that, you know, do a check-in?
Getting implemented?
Are there any success metrics? You know, for example, a 360-degree survey, feedback about your boss. I mean, who wants to do that, right?
Yeah. So when you talk about 360-degree feedback, because even if it is anonymous, there is still a way that people get to know. So employees do not tend to be completely open and transparent about it.
Yeah, true.
So, you know, interestingly, I was in discussions with one, she was a leadership coach, and she was telling me in one of her clients, what they were doing was they had... of course, with the discussion with the management team, they had cameras in their meeting rooms and everything. So whenever a leader used to have a meeting, they used to check the recordings and used to see the leaders in their element and then evaluate that leader, that how are they going? How are they developing? Are they really implementing the learnings that they have gotten? And that is how they were evaluated, and then whatever the process happens, and that is how they used to take in. Because again, with them, 360-degree feedback was not working as much.
Yeah, that's it's hit and miss always. I don't know how many people are comfortable with being on camera. And once you know that there's a camera in the room, you know, you become more conscious. But that's not a bad thing. You know, that's why you have speed cameras on the road.
True,
right?
Yep.
Because it'll flash you if you sneeze. Yeah, we have something like that for leaders in rooms. As soon as your a leader acts like an authoritative, not not authoritative, but act more like, you know, I want to use a few expletives, but I'll be nice. You know, not nice leaders. Then, you know, it should flash you. I mean, wouldn't that be nice? Who knows? With AI and everything, that's probably the future of learning and development.
That'd be so weird. If let's say you are in that position, just hypothetically, how would that be for you? That you're always under surveillance and, you know, somebody's watching if you do something wrong, not as good as a leader that you behave. And
yeah, so I think there are a couple of things for that, right? Nobody wants to be policed.
Of course, yes. Yeah.
Right? But of the same accord, I drive or try to drive safely even when I know there are no speed cameras. Because I'm conscious about not causing an accident.
Yeah.
Not hurting somebody. When I've been on the motorway, if I'm honest with you, with speed cameras, I've got caught. Because I get so in my own world that I start to speed a little. Okay. Not massively. Like, you know, I've got probably like, I don't know, at 10, 70
kilometers.
10 kilometers or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's not those, the fines that have gotten me. It's the fact that, you know, why weren't you paying more attention, Lizelle? Where was your mind? You could have caused an accident. So I think that there are some people who behave well when they know that they're under surveillance.
Yeah.
Or they're being watched. And then there are some people who don't need that because they aim to be like that all the time. But we're humans. We will make mistakes.
Absolutely.
You know, you will make mistakes. You will have an off day. I mean, God knows I've had my off days. And I've gone and apologized to my team. You know, a leader, you should have the courage to be able to say sorry. When you've been an absolute, I'm sorry, pardon my French, a prick. So you've got to do that. And I'm the first person to put my hands up. I'll reflect, I'll come back, I'll say, listen, I'm really sorry. I wasn't my best self yesterday. It was a one-off. You know, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I caused any upset or, you know. And I think my team appreciates that about me.
Yeah, I think that's very beautiful because when you also said that being directive to your team, but also telling the reason, so being transparent that why are you being directive, because maybe because there is some, you know, important deadlines, or as you mentioned right now, that you also need to show that a leader is also a human being, can also make mistakes, so that you are setting the right expectations to the people. And I think when you accept your fault as a leader, if I, like, I'm working in your team and you as a leader, I see that you're accepting your fault and you're apologetic about it, you understand it, I would be more respectful towards you rather than thinking, oh, I mean, like,
she doesn't know what she's doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, when we are talking about fear and respect used to go hand in hand, and there was such crap.
It is absolute crap.
Yeah, I would on every single time I would respect a person who is so much aware and conscious about what they're doing, who is reflective enough, who introspect about, and also is out there and care for other people.
Guys, this is only part one of the amazing Lizelle, and we have so much more for you, like emotional intelligence, how to be really an inclusive leader, where Lizelle would be sharing her own personal stories and examples specifically for you to be better.
And
for that, you forward to tune in to the next episode, which will be coming out very soon. If you want to stay ahead of the curve and dig deep into the fabric of modern work, you know what to do. Hit that follow button, share this podcast with your network, and drop us a review on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you tune in. Your feedback not only supports us, but also helps us connect with more inquisitive minds like yours. By the way, if you're looking to get in touch with today's guest, I've got you covered. Check out the description for their contact details. And if you feel inspired to chat directly with me about these compelling subjects, you can book a quick call through my Calendly or shoot me an email. All the links are in the description. This is your host, Kritika Kashyap, reminding you that the future of work is here and it's evolving fast. So let's explore it together. Until next time.